everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I am Elliot Zagman, and with me is my co-host, joining us from Vancouver, where he is hanging out, eating pizza with his good friend, Meng Wanzhou. It's James Hull.
I guess in my dreams, or I wish, or I don't know.
But you are in Vancouver, though. But not
I am in Vancouver. Yeah, no, I am having coffee, and it's late. So, so I'll get the disclaimer out of the way here. Nothing said on this podcast should be construed as investment advice or a solicitation of services. Even our numbers may be incorrect or off. Investing is risky. Speak with your financial advisor and do your own research before making investment decisions. Also, while you're listening to this podcast, why don't you open up www.technode.com/newsletters and sign up for some newsletters.
Yeah, so we got no guests today, just me and you, James. We got plenty of things to go through. We got Huawei, we got economic data, we have Xiaomi going against Samsung in India, we got Tencent, WeChat, ByteDance. But first, let's get at Huawei first. A lot going on with Huawei. We've seen kind of more detentions of Canadians, travel bans. We saw a drug smuggler, Canadian drug smuggler, get retried and given the death penalty, which Justin Trudeau spoke about. The embassies of the United States and Canada have issued travel warnings for people traveling to China. Things continue to intensify. And in Poland, a Chinese executive for Huawei was arrested on suspicion of espionage, which is an interesting case.
Along with someone from the Polish intelligence services. So there's two people there. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, we don't have too much information. There's a few things that I think are noteworthy about this. One is that Huawei fired the guy. So after his arrest, Huawei let him go.
I mean, that's Huawei basically saying, hey, if you do this, we're not gonna back you, right? That's kind of the message to other Huawei employees.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, so it's complicated. They leaked the information to the Global Times. The Global Times reported it. Xinhua and People's Daily did not. So for those who are, I say most of our listeners probably don't follow, you know, Chinese media companies very closely. The Xinhua, People's Daily, CGTN, these are kind of fully, wholly owned kind of party mouthpieces or Chinese government mouthpieces. Global Times is state media, but not entirely state media. They're also somewhat privately funded, so they have a little more flexibility. So they also, even though they can be kind of a nationalistic, propaganda rag at times, they also sometimes really impress with good journalism from time to time. And so they reported this. However, Huawei did not, which I would imply there's some kind of deviation between Huawei and the Chinese Foreign Service when it comes to this.
Is the implication that maybe this is not real?
That
it's not real? They weren't actually fired. That they didn't actually fire this person.
No, I think that Huawei. We have no reason to believe that they didn't. I think that that from what I understand, the state media outlets, the more directly controlled state media outlets, found it to be too sensitive of an issue to report on. So they didn't. But it is interesting when looking at kind of the soul searching that's happening and the message management that Huawei is trying to do here. Ren Zhengfei spoke 2 days ago, that was the 15th, to a group of reporters in Shenzhen. So for those who are not aware, Ren Zhengfei is the 74-year-old founder and kind of spiritual figurehead of Huawei, and also the father of Meng Wanzhou, who is being detained in house arrest in Canada right now. And, you know, Ren is notoriously secretive. He doesn't go out in public very often. So it was very interesting to hear him talk. He reflected in a...
By the way, another word for secretive is shy.
Shy. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That should be said. He doesn't like being in public. That's it. Right.
In the limelight. Yeah.
Yeah. So he spoke about his relationship with Meng Wanzhou and his other two daughters. He expressed some regret about not spending as much time with them. You know, kind of showing this personal side that he very rarely shows. And which also is very interesting because Huawei is known for, you know, basically saying, you know, it's us as our employees' number one obligation. And that means family is number two. They intentionally separate people from employees from their families so that they limit distractions. Ren is known to, is rumored to have told an executive who wanted to be relocated to be with his wife to get a divorce. Ren himself has been divorced twice. So hearing this kind of this reflection about, you know, looking back at his own life and his own relationship with his family, I thought was very interesting. He also clarified about how, you know, saying that the number one obligation that Huawei has not to the Chinese government, not to the Chinese Communist Party either, even though he is a member of the Chinese Communist Party and claims to be a loyal patriot. But he said his number one obligation is to his customers, you know, saying to me, I found this very interesting. And I think that this is an issue that is at the core of China and Chinese companies in the world, right? That the Chinese system has long demanded, you know, complete number one, you know, that has demanded that party members be loyal to the party above else, to put, you know, party before country, country before everything else. And so, and what Ren is saying is, you know, is he saying that's not the case for Huawei?
So can I interject here for a second? So, I mean, you know, Huawei is saying that they're not using their data, their customer data, and giving it to the government, right? That's what they're saying.
And saying that if there was a request, they would reject it.
Right, right. So if we go back to, I don't know, was it 2012, Edward Snowden's sort of revelations were that Apple and Facebook and all these companies basically had, they weren't top level executives, but there were middle level people that were creating connections between their data centers and the NSA, right? So it wasn't necessarily someone from Ren Zhengfei's level that was making these things happen. And so I don't know, like when I, you wrote a really good article about this. And when I was reading it, I kind of thought like, you know, it's sort of like you have two big brothers in the world, right? It's like China or the US. And you kind of have to pick a big brother. You know, do you want to use a Huawei phone or do you want to use an Apple phone? And that's a really simplified, ridiculous way of viewing it. I totally understand that. And I get it. But for some reason, it's sort of in some level, and it's an absurd level, I guess, but it does sort of come down to that to some degree.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah. I think it comes down to, one, to priorities, and two, to issues of transparency. You know, I think, yeah, we've seen what was really interesting, the parallels between, you know, what we learned about Facebook and Google, these U.S. tech companies during the Snowden revelations, and what happened with this guy in Poland, is that, you know, he apparently, you know, we don't know, he allegedly was spying for the Chinese government as an employee for Huawei. So it may not have been sanctioned from the top levels of the company, but that the company kind of served as a, for lack of a better term, a Trojan horse, or some, as a vehicle through which, these governments can operate. I've written.
That's, your article's really good. I think we should put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Thank you. It's James. It's very, very nice very of awesome. You to say. I do think a lot of this has to do with interests, right? So, you know, Huawei is not a publicly held company, right? So who are they accountable to? They're accountable to their employees and they're accountable to the government. Plus, I think that there is this very...
The customers?
Yes, and customers. But within China, there is a... there's a very strong ideological focus that puts, the party above all else, and especially among Ren's generation. And if they're not a public company, I do think that it limits the transparency. And whether it is true or not, I can't say, I don't know, but it makes it harder to trust the company. That's for sure. And that when from the perspective that I take, is that the more open that a company can be about what they're doing with information, about how they're governed, about what their leadership is, and the more that the demographics can represent their users, which is not the case with Huawei. You know, Huawei, almost half of Huawei's users are not Chinese. They operate in 180.
So you mean the executives at the company and the board and the management? Yeah.
Yes.
And so, whether their board is representative of the demographic of their customer base. I think I get. Yeah. I mean, I don't know who's on the board of Huawei. I actually don't know.
Well, I've written a good amount about Huawei. They have a supervisory board and an executive board, right? So a team of senior executives, and they control the majority of they're in power and control of the company. They're all Chinese. They all have been with the company for at least 20 years, and none of them, at least on the company website, lists a foreign degree, right? So it's at least from a perception point of view, they are very they're very insular. Right. So, and they certainly in their demographics do not represent their global users. So, from my point of view, I do think that's where I have an issue with Huawei is that, they're so closed and they want to be a global company, but they want to do so while remaining very closed in their management, which I think is,
They do disclose their board of directors on their website, it makes sense. A Chinese company. I mean, I'm sure they have executives at different levels in their foreign operations.
Yeah.
That are from those countries, I'd imagine. If we go back to this choosing the big brother you want sort of analogy. You want a big brother that's kind of can represent you in some way, like, right? And then is also transparent, right? And that if they do something wrong, you can have some recourse against them for misusing your data or doing, I think that makes total sense.
And I think it does that Huawei is in many ways very reflective, and the issues that they face are very reflective of the issues that kind of China faces when we look at China in the world, which is that, we see that China is very, and the Communist Party is very resolute in remaining kind of closed in how they operate. And yet they want to have, they're attempting to have a global reach. So to expand globally while remaining closed internally, I think, and it's a very difficult thing to do. And we see this both with Huawei and with kind of China and the Communist Party altogether, which I think leads to a lot of issues.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like, in a way, I mean, the world is open, right? I mean, there's a lot of openness in the world, right? There's, you can go on the internet and you can watch C-SPAN. You can see all the stuff that goes on in the U.S. and to detriment or benefit, right? It's like, it looks like chaos sometimes. And then you can also go to, you know, any World Bank, the IMF websites. I mean, there's tons and tons of data and information and reports and the, what they're doing and thinking. I mean, even the Federal Reserve has tons. I mean, there's tons of information out there. And yeah, when you kind of take all that information and you could put that compared to China and their institutions, there's definitely less information. And that's leading to usually people just, when there's a dearth of information, you kind of assume the worst, right? Mm. You go, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going on here. I'm just going to imagine what's going on. And that's going to be my fear instinct. And it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
It's going to be negative and scary, right? So yeah, it's sort of like if you're going to, you can be like, if I played poker and everyone at the table had to play with their cards open where I could see them and I was the only player with my cards closed, who do you think is going to walk away with everyone's money at the end of the game?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, it's a little unfair. So, I mean, you know, I think that's in a very odd way, that's kind of an underlying tension. That's probably not going to be resolved quickly, right? That's not an easy one to change. And that, you know, that's a trade that leads to the trade tensions, that leads to where we're at.
And it leads to in Huawei's case, so I don't know how many accusations about Huawei are true or untrue. I do know that some of the accusations are untrue and that they are at times painted to be more sinister than they are. But the way that they do business and the way that they communicate with the world, from my perspective, I don't think that they're doing themselves any favors. So, and, you know,
yeah, I mean, the same thing happens to you. I mean, like, look at US companies that go through problems. If they're not in front of the message and out there and communicating and making things clear about how they're fixing it and all that stuff, they get painted bad too. I mean, this is what the US Western media does. If you're not out there presenting your message, you're going to be trampled on. You're going to be it's going to look bad.
I think that, you know, we see this both with China and with Huawei is that they do attempt to, you know, share information, but it is very selective in how and when they share. So it becomes, you know, you have, you know, these, you know, CGTN or China Daily that paints this picture that is, you know, it's obviously propaganda, you know, and it's not necessarily untrue, but it is a very selective picture of the country. And I think it's very similar with Huawei. You know,
something.
But they're also not a public company, so they're not disclosing the information that everyone else has to disclose. And it's the same thing with China, is that they're not an open system, so they can decide, you know, what they share.
Yeah, and they also don't have a lot of practice in an open system.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, they don't know what to do. I kind of think that's part of it. And I think there's probably maybe a cultural thing. I don't know. I mean, the US is very open, like an extent that's, I don't know if that's replicated elsewhere. But that doesn't happen overnight. that took a long time, and it's kind of an organic thing. So yeah, I think there's probably, it's a hard thing to, because it's not like, how does someone help China become more, like, get more comfortable being open?
It's their internal affairs. It's their business.
They need a good PR company.
And this is obviously far bigger than, you know, we can talk about in just, you know, an hour long podcast, but the, you know, it all comes down to how they, you know, decide they want to manage themselves, both at Huawei and, you know, in China altogether. And then the rest of the world can decide how they interact with that. But which means that there are going to be either positive or negative consequences for, you know, whatever happens internally. It's a complicated situation. And when it comes to, you know, a company like Huawei, you know, it's a tough situation to be in. But it also, you know, I work a lot more, you know, and a lot of the companies that we cover in this podcast they're not these like legacy, bigger, older tech companies like Huawei. You know, they're these smaller, more nimble, you know, they're startups. So they just IPO'd. They're younger. Run by people in their 30s, you know, and it's so different in talking to the kind of people that run these companies. You know, they are very, very good at being open and transparent. You know, if you just compare the kind of Chinese companies that are IPOing right now versus the companies that IPO'd 10 years ago and what they're disclosing, how prepared they are, and how they interact with both the public and their own employees, it's night and day. And it is kind of a shame when we see, these tensions coming about, all these issues that we're reading about in the news every day, to see this younger generation of entrepreneurs in China that have so much going for them and that are such impressive people and have such impressive businesses, you know, getting painted with this brush that, you know, they and, you know, having the weight of politics on their shoulders that, you know, they don't want and they don't really, you know, deserve to have either. So it's a shame, I think. And it's disappointing, and hopefully, you know, we'll see some better developments. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same, just to put a parallel, it's the same in the US. I mean, you see AOC, the Democrat socialist from the Bronx, she's like a genius on Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, then she's like teaching the older Democrats how to use Twitter now. I mean, it's like, it is a generational thing. I think that's, yeah.
Yeah, totally. But and I mean, if you want to use the metaphor of American politics, right? You know, I am sometimes a little frustrated when we see these, you know, Donald Trump's in his 70s, you know, Joe Biden is thinking about running for president, he's almost 80, right? You know, all these older folks, when we have this younger generation who is, you know, so much more forward thinking, they're clued in with technology. It's so much. I see the same thing in China in the business community, this younger generation of people that are so forward thinking, you know, that have so much energy, you know, that are very innovative. And, you know, you really want to be able, you want to see them, you know, take the reins and be able to show their stuff. Anyways, other news with Huawei, we don't have to go into it with too many details. More bad news. The Justice Department in the US is apparently going after them and their employees for IP theft of T-Mobile?
T-Mobile's smartphone testing technology, supposedly for allegedly stealing trade secrets. And this looks like it's a little bit of a change. Instead of like the political tariff angle, like using the judicial kind of federal prosecution angle, that seems like it's turning up the heat. It's like an increase of tensions.
Well, they're coming after.
Whereas tariffs, I feel like, weren't.
They're coming after China and China Tech and Huawei in particular from so many different angles.
It's. And this looks like it's going after individuals. I mean, I think based on, because it's criminal investigations. I think that's usually an individual type stuff. And it should, I'm guessing it's individual employees.
Wait. Anyways, yes, that's enough for about Huawei for today. You know, we can talk about it every day. But we have kind of this weekend slowdown that every week we kind of are seeing, you know, the tariffs start to, you know, come into play, and we're seeing this slowdown in the Chinese economy. James, we have any data that you found particularly noteworthy this past week?
I guess the only other thing was that there was also, you know, the Apple resellers in China. So that's like JD, which is on our watch list, and I guess Suning, which is Alibaba backed. Alibaba's on a watch list. They're lowering their iPhone prices on their platforms. And that seems to be kind of in response to Apple's update that was so negative, and just, I guess, general slowdown. And I mean, they really did make the iPhone too expensive. But
yeah. Well, I mean, also it's a, I mean, we have the bigger, we can move on to talking about the bigger, you know, issue with smartphones, and, you know, with Xiaomi in particular is on our watch list. So Samsung is, you know, kind of going harder into India, where Xiaomi has been gaining market share with some lower end phones of their own.
They actually announced an initiative to have India first smartphones that are meant to compete against their Chinese, to go directly compete against their Chinese competitors, which I guess is Xiaomi and others.
Huawei.
That's a big deal. Samsung pulling out of China, right?
And then repositioning
to have India first phones that are made specifically for that market. That's an interesting, I mean, the smartphone wars, you know, as we reach like kind of more and more smartphone saturation, you know, the smartphone wars are going to be about stealing or winning market share from their competitors, not just getting new users, right?
Yeah.
And that'll be, you know, very interesting to watch, I think.
Yeah, it looks like when looking, I mean, the India market, you know, for China tech, I think is super fascinating. You know, we've seen just a rise in app downloads from Chinese apps. You know, I wrote about, you know, ByteDance's Hello, their news app. You know, TikTok seems to be having some success in India. But when it comes to smartphones, I think, you know, the winner here is the Indian consumer. Because these companies are fighting an intense battle over the Indian consumer. And basically, it seems as though, I mean, somebody can come at me and you know, let me know if I'm wrong here. But we basically have five players, and three of them are Chinese. So there's Apple, and there's Samsung that have kind of dominated the high end. But Samsung is now trying to get further into the low end here because they're seeing that they're not going to be able to maintain that dominance. And then you have Huawei, you have Xiaomi, and then you have the BKK brands, which are Vivo, Oppo, OnePlus. And all of these companies are fighting viciously for these Indian smartphone users because it's one of the only areas where we're really seeing growth.
Well, India is also the second largest smartphone market behind China. So, I mean, this is serious chips on the table here.
And what we saw with China in 2013 and 2014, where, I mean, that was really when Xiaomi took off, right? That was when Xiaomi had their, you know, their, they, you know, kind of rose to prominence by having lower end phones that were getting at these people in, you know, that were getting on smartphones for the first time. Same thing with Huawei's Honor. You know, this is how they've had success. And this is how companies like Meizu, like Coolpad, like, what is it, Gioni, right? You know, we've seen these lower-end phones brands that they kind of, they raised a bunch of money. They started, you know, gaining some market share, but they're all collapsing right now. You know, Coolpad just let go of their CEO. Gioni had a big issue with their founder and CEO's having a gambling addiction. And blowing a bunch of the company's money, and we're seeing
can investors recoup some of that? I mean, like,
I have no idea.
That is pretty bad. Wow. Okay.
And Meizu's having a lot of trouble too. So we're seeing in China that lower tier that was not able to internationalize or raise enough capital, kind of falling off. And then we're seeing your BKK, which is the Oppo, Vivo, Xiaomi, and then Huawei, Honor, you know, they're kind of the ones that are left standing here. We'll see. Another thing I'm noticing with Xiaomi here in Bangkok is the advertisements that I see for their products. They advertise all over the subway, the BTS here. And the advertisements they used to be a lot for their phones. They still are somewhat for their phones, but more than anything else is for their IoT devices. You know, their air purifiers, their version of the Roomba, these connected devices, that I think that Xiaomi sees as a way to really establish a foothold for their ecosystem.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. I don't know. I mean, if the idea is that they're going to use a Roomba and an air purifier to get me to buy their internet services, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to work.
I don't know.
I mean, the funny thing is, even analysts of Apple, okay, mm-hmm. which you wouldn't think compared to Xiaomi would have this problem, but even analysts of Apple wonder if Apple can get their services level up to a point where it's like meaningful for the company.
So, and they have all the rich people.
I mean, yeah, Apple. And they have the luxury product that is, you know, I mean, it's sort of, you kind of wonder if it's like, if it really is all the rich people or if people buy an Apple iPhone because it looks like a luxury product.
Well, it's both. Like right. Most luxury brands, they'll, you know?
Of course. Yeah. So, I mean, if Apple's having that problem, I think Xiaomi's going to have it for quite a while. I don't think it's not going to be like 1 year. Oh, here, see, we increased it by 100%. And now it's, you know, 15% of revenue instead of 6, you know, or it probably won't be that much. It'll probably be like 12. But I think that will still be a question. I mean, 12%, it's probably got to get to close to 40 to be meaningful.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
And I think a big thing here, we're seeing this, we saw this with Samsung, we saw this with Apple, is that I don't think any of these companies, we knew that user growth in smartphones was slowing down. That you know, that the good years, the bumper crop was over, right? I don't think that any of them foresaw the drop-off that we're seeing now and how quickly it's happened. Apple certainly didn't foresee it. But we're seeing this pretty much across the board with smartphones. And, you know,
I hope our listeners know that we've been talking about this at least since the very beginning of this podcast, because we've been, you know, we were covering all these Chinese tech companies, right? When they were talking about their earnings, and they pretty much across the board, all of them were talking about a slowdown in China, talking about regulation issues. And anyway,
You heard it here first, folks. You heard it here first.
Got to plug it, you know.
Free podcast. It's a free podcast, guys. Let's move on to talking about Tencent. So Alan Jiang, who is some people call him the Steve Jobs of China. He he is kind of the reclusive, eccentric kind of brains behind WeChat.
Does he have a uniform?
A uniform?
Like a black turtleneck jeans uniform?
Like Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't seem like it.
Okay.
But yeah, he doesn't have the big personality that I think a lot of these, you know, like a Musk or a Steve Jobs does. But I think, you know, if there's any Chinese tech leader who, you know, compares with those two when it comes to how forward thinking they are, when it comes to kind of how much of a visionary they are, I think Alan Jiang is probably it. And I think he generally, you know, around the world is less, he's not revered, or often many people don't know who he is. But he does this open class every year where he basically talks for 4 hours and talks about, you know, what's happening with WeChat. And last year they talked about the mini programs, right, which have taken
off. By the way, this is a great thing about openness right here. 4 hour conversation broadcast, right? This is like,
yeah.
Yeah, you can go watch it.
He just talks.
It's great.
Which is very cool. And also, I mean, it's like I said, you know, these are the things that we're seeing with these younger companies that, you know, where they're looking for new ways to engage with their users. You know, they're very forward thinking. You know, and they also they grew up in a different time in China. And they think a different way. And that happened as WeChat has upgraded their new version, which includes kind of a how would I say this, like a stories type feature.
Yeah, it's kind of like stories. It's I haven't actually sent one yet, but it looks like what you do is you go to your page, your personal page, you swipe down, and then you can make a video. And then that video goes to groups that you send it to. I think you can choose. I should try and play around with it, but I think it's going after that, the video connection, the stories connection, the short time. It's only there for, you know, if you watch it, it's kind of, you know, gone in 24 hours or something.
Yeah.
And if you don't watch it, it's gone. You're not going to see it. So there's kind of like that, oh, we got to keep it. Kind of drives interaction that way. Kind of like Instagram stories, kind of like Snapchat. I think, and also maybe a little bit like ByteDance's new video chat app.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to integrate some of those features into WeChat and improve that user experience. I like the design of WeChat, but it comes as ByteDance has issued, like you said, a competitor, basically. It's called Duoshan. Matt Brennan, friend of the pod, Matt Brennan, he, you know, talked on his podcast, China Tech Talk, and on, he tweeted about this, about, you know, he's like, what is Duoshan? It's basically Snapchat. It's a Snapchat clone. And he said, you can imagine the size of relief that are happening at Tencent headquarters right now. I think that,
because there were rumors for a while about ByteDance having a messaging app coming out. And if it's anything like Snapchat, and if you look at how Snapchat's done, and this is something I'm going to be working on a little more, but if you bring a new technology to a market that you don't have any other competitive advantage except for kind of a gimmicky new technology, like a video. I mean, you could do video messaging in WeChat already, by the way. But if you don't have all the users and you're constantly buying users, the incumbents in that market are going to be able to, if they're technologically savvy, which guess what? Tech companies are going to be technologically savvy, they're going to be able to replicate your features and use their own users and drive you out of the market. And you're kind of seeing it with Snapchat and Instagram. Instagram stories have decimated Snapchat.
Especially if you have more resources, more existing users, and better management. You know, I think that, you know, also with Snapchat, I mean, Evan Spiegel's a kid. And, you know, he can't compete with Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg. You know, so say whatever you want about them. You know, the resources of Facebook, the management of Facebook, you know, it's really hard for a company like Snap to compete, which is why looking at ByteDance, you know, that's always been something that I've wondered about is just, you know, when do they get their lunch eaten by a bigger fish? That's blending two metaphors. But one thing that stood out to me
bite.
In looking at what was that?
It's like getting their lunch bitten by ByteDance. Anyway, I'm trying to never mind. It's just
one thing in looking at, and I mean, I've been covering ByteDance for a long time, writing about them, and then also they had this product launch. And then comparing that with Alan Jiang and kind of listening to him talk and kind of looking at his approach to a product. Also, friend of the pod, Ray Ma and Yingying Lu, they have the TechBuzz China podcast, which is also a really good podcast. And they were talking about, you know, Alan Jiang at WeChat as well. And you look at his product philosophy versus ByteDance's product philosophy. You know, that WeChat has always served as a tool, right? So the function of WeChat is basically, you know, the purpose is to, they want you to come in and out of the app a lot, but they don't want you to be spending all your time looking at the app, right? So, you know, you go in there, you swipe it, you pay. You go in there, you message, you're done, right? So the way that Alan Jiang looks at it is he wants WeChat to be a friend. Right, which is one of the reasons why he doesn't monetize it as much as maybe it could be.
They're very slow. I think it was. I think WeChat was a cost center for them for quite a long time.
Yeah,
might still be. Actually.
It could be. I wouldn't be surprised.
Now that they lost the WeChat.
They don't have. Yeah. You know, if you look at, you know, for example, Zhihu, or you know, use any of these other, you know, or I think Weibo is like this as well. When you open up the app, you'll see an advertisement.
Every Chinese app. That's like almost every Chinese app, you open it. I mean, any of them. QQ Music, so Tencent Music does that. Xiaomi, obviously Tmall, Taobao, JD. I mean, they all, yeah.
And WeChat has resisted doing this and has also just resisted advertisements in their platform. And they've resisted. They're not really integrating algorithms into it much, which I think keeps it it maintains a level of simplicity, and you know I think more usability. And so if you look at that,
you know, there's an interesting parallel. You know, if you want to create, let's say, a brand, right, in I don't know, let's say cars, okay? If you start at the low end and you offer a cheap product and then you try to move up to a luxury product, guess what? You're going to have a really hard time. If you start with the luxury product and then you move down, it's actually much easier to create those kind of sub-brands that are different. I think Alan Jiang is very smart in that he has to keep kind of WeChat in the same way. It's not a cheap product, you know. It's sort of it's something that you know, they're kind of protecting the quality of it, trying to make sure it's valuable, has this appeal, you know, and they're not trying to degrade it. And that's key. That's super key.
Yeah, and to be sure, there are probably a lot other stakeholders. You know, the government regulators are probably involved as well. I mean, WeChat is incredibly popular.
There's also probably people fighting him.
Mm.
I bet internally there's people who are like, come on, let's get the money out of this thing. You know, it's ready.
Yeah.
Sheryl Sandberg did with Facebook. She went to Facebook and really milked it, you know?
Well, and that's what brings to the next point that I want to talk about when comparing them with ByteDance, is that ByteDance is very similar to the Facebook's approach, in that Facebook said, okay, how do we get the most out of this platform as a company? They said, okay, we're going to instead of just people checking it once or twice a day, we're going to make them live on our platform, right? So we're going to add algorithms. We're going to do all sorts of things to engage people, right? And then now we're seeing that this also has a whole series of psychological and sociological effects that we did not
negative
have. Right.
Effects.
Negative effects. And, you know, ByteDance, I think, is...
But that's like cheap. I'd call that cheap, low-quality stickiness.
Yeah.
Compared to like high-quality tool stickiness, it's totally different.
And you mentioned with TikTok, you know, if you look at one of our first episodes, you were talking about how it covers it takes up the entire screen. It covers your clock. So you don't see any other messages. You don't see what time it is. It's a casino. Right, that's what they do. No, no windows, no clocks in the casino. Right, they take out your entire attention. Right, they get you addicted, and then they. I have gotten in trouble by comparing them to a drug dealer's business model. But
we all know, ByteDance is your favorite Chinese company.
But speaking of which, they do have what seems to be announced their sales numbers. And they were towards the lower end of what was anticipated.
Which is better than Apple.
Yes. So if they're still good sales numbers.
I mean, or they're conservative. I don't know.
But if you take that into consideration, that maybe their sales growth is slowing down because of issues with the Chinese economy, plus the regulations that are being put in place with how much they need to be, you know, how many people they need to pay to monitor their apps. I think that we're looking at some issues for their bottom line. So, anyways,
I like iQIYI more now that they have those regulations, by the way, because I think that was the key. Competitive advantage that ByteDance had was that they didn't have to deal with the regulations, the content regulations. And now that they have to deal with those, and, you know, there's some pushback, which I think you're a part of, but there's some pushback against ByteDance, at least on the international areas. I think iQIYI's got a chance to do better.
Well, James, I've been screaming at the top of my lungs about this. Anyone who's been listening to this podcast.
All right, what's next?
Let's see. We talked about iPhone prices on JD and Suning. What about there was the report about the billionaires?
Just real quick. Yeah. Real quick about Alibaba. So, I mean, and this is maybe kind of, I don't know if our audience will appreciate it, but... You know, just looking at their chart, I mean, they have kind of clearly hit a double bottom here around 130, and they've kind of bounced back. And there was an article like that, you know, that basically BAT stocks performed, and I think JD was included, performed very well after the announcement of some economic stimulus. Mm. But the stimulus that was announced, maybe we should talk about that. Actually, we should talk about that. The stimulus that was announced was basically, it's focused on smaller companies. And they're going to get, they get to pay lower social kind of taxes or social welfare payments if they don't fire anyone. So it's this very bizarre type of stimulus, which is clearly trying to support employment, right? They don't want mass unemployment. Mm. So if you keep your stats, so I guess you can do the math. You can sit at your desk and you can calculate, okay, if I fire this many people or if I keep them and I can save this much on social kind of taxes, fees, and whatever. Maybe I don't have to, maybe I don't, I shouldn't, maybe it makes more sense to keep those people and have the savings over here. Or maybe it makes more sense to fire them. And I know you've talked about layoffs. You've written a good article about that. I think the other stimulus was there was some kind of the PBOC is kind of injecting money, which is typical around this time of year. Chinese New Year is coming. And what always happens every Chinese New Year is everyone needs cash that they have to pay for bonuses. Because yeah. It's got to go in red envelopes and, you know.
Everyone's got to bring it back home.
Everyone's got to bring it back home and be like, oh, I got the, you know, hong bao. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this I think it's a typical thing. I don't know if there is some press out there that's kind of overblowing it a bit. But I think it's a normal thing. Then there was also the rate reserve ratio requirement that was reduced. But yeah, the other bit of news. Yeah.
We're clearly seeing that this, you know, the PBOC, is taking steps to increase or to improve liquidity, you know, to avoid a credit crunch. I think for those of us who are, you know, hoping at least for the markets to rebound, I think, you know, we're hoping for more, but who knows? I mean, it's one of those things that everyone thinks they know what they're talking about with it, but I don't think anyone really knows. But I know you were following that story about those billionaires.
So four billionaires transferred $17 billion to trusts on, like, before the 2019. So some of those, I think, were on December 31st, and maybe some slightly before. And I think this was reported, and it was said that they're trying to kind of get around some new tax changes that are happening in China. But the problem is the tax changes haven't specified how they're going to treat trusts. And these are overseas trusts. I think one of them at least was in the U.S. Mm. But anyway, this is, you know, remember all those stories about people taking money out of the country and capital flight and all that stuff. This is maybe, you know, could be categorized as that.
A restructured form of capital flight.
Yeah, but also it's not cash necessarily that's transferred, it's value of shares they own that they're transferring to a trust. So it's not like they have a bunch of this much cash, liquid just flying around. It's usually in shares of the companies. And so anyway, it's only four guys, maybe more. I don't know. The smaller ones maybe aren't watched as closely by the journalists, but these four guys had $17 billion worth of wealth transferred.
And I mean, I often work with, you know, founders and chief executives at companies. And
I should say one was a woman. Sorry.
Okay.
Three guys, one woman.
You get a lot of these folks who will talk about kind of the historical parallels, especially if they're particularly pessimistic about the future of the Chinese economy. And it's they look at, you know, the fall of the Qing Dynasty during the White Lotus Rebellion or the, you know, the Taiping Civil War, and as the empire struggled to, you know, remain stable, they had to call on the wealth of their, you know, private business people, and so, you know, we saw these titans of industry basically. In the south of China, particularly like in periods like the 1800s, completely lose their fortunes. So if you are a wealthy business person in China right now, you know, these are the parallels that they're bringing up, right? This idea that when the shit hits the fan, you know, they're the ones who are going to be left paying the bill.
I think, it's sort of true everywhere. You know, I hate to kind of always be bringing up parallels, but taxes go up in times of, you know, not always, but typically governments that are struggling raise taxes. And they usually raise it on the wealthy. They're made to be evil in some way or taking advantage of society. That is a very typical thing. And I don't think China's unique in that.
Sure. Yeah, I think one difference with China is that it doesn't mean that the way that things work in China is that, you know, if you get, it's not like you're getting, you know, okay, some of your income taken away or some of your wealth taken away. Oftentimes it can be far more serious than that. You know, it can be some sort of investigation. It can be some sort of, you know, loss of power or life or whatnot, you know, where I think that, you know, people are a little more concerned about stuff like that, you know, because the stakes are a little bit higher in China than they might be elsewhere. Anyways.
All right. So, I'm not going to riff on that. we can close that one.
Right. So let's finish. I guess we could finish up the pod for today. But let's say, so first of all, we want to tell you, as always, to go to techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech, including sometimes some stuff from me. Or some links to pieces from me that I wrote or things like that. Also, you can follow us on Twitter at Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN, or James at James Hull X, JAMESHULLX. Yeah, James, anything else we need to let people know? Are you looking forward to anything?
Well, I think Brexit is so far not happening, at least as it was planned. And yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens with the meeting coming up with Liu He in the U.S. That should be interesting. And I guess thank you to John Artman for editing and producing this podcast.
Producer extraordinaire.
Yes.
One more thing I'm looking for. I've been following Chu Toutiao, which is this this news aggregator app that went public back in like September, and they've just been super volatile lately. They were in late December on Christmas Eve, December 24, they were like $5.08. Then they spiked up to $9.50 per share on January 10th, and now they're back down to $7.50 per share as of January 16th. So they just keep going up and down and up and down. You know, they're super volatile. I don't know why. So if anyone knows anything about this company, please contact me and let me know. But anyways, once again, also thank you to producer extraordinaire John Artman, and we'll see you next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.